I'm Mitch Albom of the Detroit Free Press.
I'm Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe and ESPN.
I'm Mike Lupica of MSNBC and MLB.com, and welcome to the Friday edition of the Sports Reporters Podcast. We come to you every Monday and Friday. It is a continuation of our long-running show on Sunday mornings on ESPN, and we were so happy to put the band back together. And even 10 days out from the Super Bowl 53, we're going to start with football today, because as we tape this on Friday morning, it is now 5 days since the single most impactful call in the history of NFL conference championship games, or non-calls. And that was the one in the Saints-Rams game last Sunday in the Super Bowl. An outrageous pass interference and helmet-to-helmet hit, all in one, two for the price of one, that did not get called. And guess what? All this time later, we have not gotten an official response from the National Football League, nor its commissioner, Roger Goodell. And all I keep reading is, well, they addressed it after the game. Well, they addressed it after the game, guys, because Sean Payton said that he had called the league office, and they said they blew the call. But nothing from Goodell. And once again, God, you're being a great commissioner, Commissioner.
Well, you know, maybe if they paid the guy a little money, you know, he'd respond a little more forcefully.
Yeah, he's practically a furloughed federal employee, isn't he, Bob?
God, don't get me started on Wilbur Ross. Now, thing is taken on an astonishing life of its own, which always speaks to the importance of the National Football League and our national dialogue. And that's, I'm not being facetious there. It's true. This is a surpassing importance to untold millions of people, how things come out in the National Football League. And it's not going to go away. It's only festering as the commissioner sits by idly. The city of New Orleans has lost its collective mind over the whole thing, which is nice to know they care this much about football. But to the point where the latest development is that certain bars apparently are going to boycott showing the Super Bowl on Sunday evening, the 3rd of February. But they will instead show a replay of the 2010 Super Bowl, which, by the way, was won by, yes, the New Orleans Saints.
Yeah, good luck with that. Let's see how much beer you sell at that. The Roger Goodell thing doesn't surprise me, because he runs the NFL a bit like the monarchy runs Britain. They do things on their own time. You don't tell them when they speak. You don't tell the Queen, hey, you need to come out and say something. The Queen will do it as per her schedule. And this is pretty much what Roger Goodell's answer has been. Well, we'll talk about this when I have my annual meeting with the media at the Super Bowl next Wednesday. You know, that's how we do things here in the NFL, and I'll speak about it then. The fact that he doesn't seem to think that this warrants a commissioner's comment at this point tells you everything you need to know about the hubris of Roger Goodell and the untouchability of the NFL. Because you're right, Bob, where's anybody going? Are they going to stop watching the Super Bowl outside of that bar, or are they going to do it anyhow? And that's the attitude that you get the sense. And I don't blame Saints tight end Benjamin Watson, who's retiring, so what does he care, for sending that social media post that says basically, you know, what occurred in New Orleans was outside of the expected. Normally, it was so polite. Your continued silence on this matter is unbecoming of the position you hold, detrimental to the integrity of the game, and disrespectful and dismissive to football fans everywhere. And he's 100% right. And if he were still in the league, he'd probably get suspended. But that's who Goodell is. That's who the NFL is. And this thing runs the danger, Mike and Bob, of starting to tilt history a little bit. It is an egregious non-call. It should absolutely have been called, and they should absolutely, in my mind, visit the possibility of, in the final 2 minutes, somehow being able to review calls like this. I agree with the critics who say you can't do this all game long. You can't have a pass interference call reviewed in the first quarter, or the games are going to be 9 hours long. But when you get to that critical point, and in the NFL, they do identify the critical point as the final 2 minutes. That's why the rules all change in the final 2 minutes for replay anyhow. It seems to me you could come up with a system where you at least get one challenge or something like that, where you do look at an egregious penalty. They do it in the CFL. They look at pass interference in the CFL. But Mike and Bob, don't you also think that this is getting to the point where they're starting to act like the Saints absolutely 100% deserved to win that game, would have won it any minute, and are forgetting the fact that they did get the ball in overtime and still didn't win the game?
It should have been next season by then. Yes. All of those things happen, Mitch, but they're irrelevant to the fact that the game should have been over. Everybody should have been in the locker room. Yeah, they did get the ball, and he did throw a dumb interception. So, yes, they did have chances. They had a chance that Mahomes didn't have in Kansas City. But to me, that you know, we've talked about how we think the rules should be over. Changed. This is about their reaction. But when has Goodell ever seriously and in a thoughtful way addressed what has happened to Colin Kaepernick? The answer to that is never. The answer to that is never, and he probably never will, unless he gets asked about it again next Wednesday. They used to have this on Friday. We used to call it Pete Rozelle's greatest hits because he was the best at the commissioner's press conference ever, okay? But it's become such a non-event that they moved it into the middle of Super Bowl week. And again, this, you're right. This is about the arrogance of this league. And guess what? Even with Kaepernick, they don't have to talk about that anymore. They're going good again. They had an unbelievable season. The ratings are up. They're indestructible. It's like the 10 stages of drunkenness from Dan Jenkins. Invisible and bulletproof. That's what Roger Goodell is in this instance.
No, they're right. They're coming off two tremendous weeks ends for them. They got the dream scenario of having the top four offensive teams and teams that have made them big news during the year and so forth. So, yeah, they're riding high once again. And I apparently are hoping they can ride this thing out and without, you know, ruffling any more feathers. But no, I mean, it's absolutely imperial behavior. And it'll be interesting to see how it does play out when he finally does have to address it. But that's
we'll
a
have
long, another
of
week.
Time next I know, week during the Super Bowl away. To look at that. As I always say, I hope you made your Super Bowl pick already because the hype has started to begin and then you're just going to get dizzy and spin around and all the rest of it.
Next Wednesday week. In Atlanta, when he does get up, it will be a master class in nuance and ass covering. It'll be fascinating to watch, actually, this time.
All right, let's shift over to the NBA because we got plenty of time to talk about the Super Bowl. And the NBA made its All-Star selections yesterday. Not surprisingly, a lot of Golden State Warriors on that there thing. And with the return of Boogie Cousins, all concerns about the Warriors' premature demise were erroneously reported. They look as unbeatable as they have ever looked at this midway point in the season. And, you know, you could argue that you could just pretty much take the Golden State starting five and make it an all-star team in and of itself. Some thoughts on where they are right now.
Thoughts are that DeMarcus Cousins represents an upgrade from the likes of Andrew Bogut and Zazu Pachulia. They have played around the fact that they don't have a marquee or even a high quality five man, and now they have one, and he does fit into the modern game. He can step out and shoot the ball, but the point is his impact has been significant. He's fit in seamlessly. The numbers themselves include fouling out in the first game in 15 minutes, but before he did, he had 14 points and 6 rebounds. He followed that up with 8 points and 9 rebounds. And then last night, in 24 minutes, 17 points, 6 rebounds. And by the way, gentlemen, in each game, 3 assists, 5 assists, 3 assists. And he's a force. He's as skilled a big man as this league has, and we've known that. And it's going to cause a lot of head scratching if and when they cruise to the championship, having made this addition, as to how he just so casually wound up on their side. But I think it's a scary foreboding week, don't you?
Here's what it speaks to in my mind. It speaks to Steve Kerr and the culture he has created there. Okay. And maybe Steve Kerr was able to road test, assimilating someone like Boogie onto the team because he's had Draymond from the start. And he has made the culture there inclusive. And they have dealt with Draymond's, you know, they've dealt with his excesses because of his amazing talent for basketball, even though he didn't shoot the ball as well this year as he has in the past. But it's to me, And I'm not saying that the Boogie, who has been a bit of a knothead. I mean, he got, you know, Bob knows he got our friend Paul Westfall fired in Sacramento. This to me is Mitch is Rodman going to the Bulls. This to me is that kind of move. Even though I am not comparing Boogie to Rodman in all ways.
No, I understand the comparison, and it's a good one in that he doesn't have to do what all the other guys are doing.
Right.
And that's what Rodman, that's why Rodman was so invaluable to both the Pistons and the Bulls, is that he there was no Michael Jordan in him. You know, he was totally the complementary player to guys like Jordan and Pippen. He was the total complementary player to guys like Isaiah Thomas and Joe Dumars, and that's exactly who you need to be if you're going to be the fifth guy with the Warriors, and that's what makes them so complete. And it's quite possible, you know, that Green and Thompson are going to end up being on this All-Star team when they make the selections. And literally, you got a team of four All-Star players, a couple of whom are no-brainers or starters, and there have been years where Klay Thompson, you know, seems to have worked his way up there as well. There's been no collection of talent like this that I can remember across the board in the fives. LeBron James started the whole three thing, you know, where I go, two other people go with me, but they weren't on his level. Steph Curry and a Kevin Durant already broke the mold. You know, generally guys like that don't play on the same team. And then to have a Klay Thompson, Draymond Green is a little bit Rodman-ish as well, yeah, in terms of the skills that he brings.
Yeah, it's
he's
true.
Sort of, you know, he ain't there for his shooting. We all know that. But you know, he brings that toughness and that mentality and rebounding that the other guys don't have. And you know, they're 2 1-point losses away from, I think, 13 in a row here, and they just look 34-14. I don't know. I don't know if this is good for basketball or bad for basketball. There's a bit of that whole warrior fatigue thing that goes on, and that, you know, they just seem to be so much better than everybody else. On the other hand, don't you love watching that kind of excellence when you can see it? I mean, Bob, you're the basketball maven. You've gone through stretches where there have been dominant teams like this in the past. Is it generally good for the sport or bad?
That's an eternal question that we raise in various contexts. We raised it during the college football season. Is this right. Tyranny of Clemson and Alabama dominating the national championship discussion good or bad for the sport? It's an eternal question. And this goes back through the Yankees and the Celtics of the Russell era and so forth, and UCLA basketball.
You just said, when you said Patriots, you just reminded, we are living in an era right now where those three sports are all suffering from that same question. College football, NFL, and the NBA all have reigning, you know, fiefdoms of one or two teams, and that's it. Baseball's far more egalitarian when it comes to that, you know.
I saw an easy, by the way, just quickly, guys, I think I read something yesterday that since 2007, half of baseball has appeared in the World Series. And yeah. That's so whatever they're doing in that sense
is, without a salary cap, Bob, I know they have a luxury tax. This to me is for all the things that baseball gets criticized for, their template for evening the field works, and they have done it without a salary cap. And Mitch, you know, we've talked about this. We talked about this for years, and Bob on the Sports Reporters. And there's a famous old Jimmy Breslin line that the two biggest stories are big guy dies in war. Okay, and I always change for sports. I always said the two biggest stories are big guy wins or big guy loses. I like the big guy theory of sports. I do. I think it enhances it. I'm not sure, Bobby. It was great in baseball when the Yankees made 16 out of 19 World Series starting in 1949. I don't know if that was the best thing that ever happened to baseball because in this year time when everybody draws pretty great in baseball, I looked it up one time, and in the middle of that run in the late 50s, the Yankees were drawing like 1 million fans a year to Yankee Stadium. Nobody was going. I know it was a different world in sports.
Yeah, very different.
I love the Warriors story. I do. And Mitch, we talked about this, I think, a few weeks ago. Bobby Valentine was talking to me once about Mike Piazza. And he said, if you're a manager or a coach in sports and your best player is a really good guy, it filters down through the other 24 players on the team. I think that this culture that we're talking about with Golden State starts with the kid from Davidson, Steph Curry. I just think that everything I told you, Jeff Van Gundy, my favorite line about Steph from Jeff Van Gundy is he got over himself a long time ago. And I think it permeates through that. I think it permeates through that locker room.
He had a little personal milestone game last night, gentlemen. He had 38 points with only two threes, which is the most points he's ever scored while making two or fewer threes. So he's kind of went back to the future for his game last night. Now, it's a very interesting observation about him. I thought you can even go so far in this case as to say the coach fits right in there in terms of setting a great tone. I have to throw, since you mentioned the Yankees and Mike and that era, I have to throw out the great line of Ted Williams late 50s, who said, all the American League has is me and the Yankees, and when I go, the league's going to be pretty damn dull.
Yeah.
Which in the 60s, early 60s.
That's an interesting segue into the All-Star selections, where the West and the East, in terms of, you look at the people who were on it, the West, LeBron James gets elected captain despite the fact that he's missed 15 games, which I hate to say I told you so, but when it comes to groins, you know, we remember saying, look out.
You know what? You know groins.
You are groinologist.
I'm a groin.
You ever heard anybody who knows more about groins, and Mitch knows groins.
No, I would say I study them, but that would border on inappropriate. So LeBron James, Steph Curry, James Harden, Kevin Durant, and Paul George. It's ridiculous how much talent is in the West and how many guys are still waiting to find out if they're going to make that. On the East, Kyrie Irving, Kawhi Leonard, Joel Embiid, Giannis, of course, and Kemba Walker, which we talked a little before the show, is a great story. And, of all the 10 names I just mentioned, probably the most unexpected all-star if you go into his path.
Hey, but Mitch, I've known about this kid since he was in high school. When he was on the rip that took UConn all the way to an unlikely national championship, one of the assistants at UConn, Andre LaFleur, said his life is a New York City fairy tale. He comes out at, I don't want to go on with the geography of the city, but it's a historic kind of basketball geography from Seward Park and Rosedale and then Rice High School. He was a backup in high school. And Jim Calhoun, who coached him at UConn, kept telling people his senior year, even though he was 6 feet tall, he said, I got the best player in the country. And then they got hot at the Big East tournament. He made some crazy shots. They go all the way to the title. And even then, I wasn't ever sure that he would be that in the NBA. He has become that and more. The Knicks must eat their hearts out that this kid is playing in Charlotte. And Mitch, it's why it's the best story of all the All-Star selections, because the game will be played in Charlotte this year.
Yeah,
and it's just a great moment for this kid's career. His father's from Antigua. It's just a great New York City story.
And another, you're absolutely right, Mike. And I think the nice hearts and flowers story on the other side is Paul George's recovery, because he did come back from a really devastating injury, and he's clearly all the way back, which is really good news.
You know, I'm looking at the draft as you mentioned that, Mike, and not to
what was he like
back.
Seventh or eighth?
Back home, he was ninth
okay.
in the draft. The eighth pick by the Detroit Pistons of Brandon Knight.
And he took him to the
seventh
championship,
pick,
didn't he?
The Sacramento Kings, Bismack Biyombo.
He's still hanging around.
Sure. Yeah, hanging around. Ain't Kemba Walker.
Give me the rest of that draft, Mitch.
All right, number one was Kyrie Irving. Okay, that worked out pretty well by Cleveland. Number two, Derek Williams by the Minnesota Timberwolves.
Ooh, wow.
Enes Kanter by the Utah Jazz, number three. Tristan Thompson by the Cleveland Cavaliers again. Jonas Valanciunas by the Toronto Raptors.
Good player.
Jan Vesely by the Washington Wizards at number six. Biyombo by the Sacramento Kings, Brandon Knight by the Pistons, and then Kemba Walker.
Isn't that something, Mitch? You read that list, and everybody knew about Kyrie, even though he had played like
11 games.
Nine games in college?
Yeah.
11, to be precise.
Okay. And, they weren't wrong about him.
But Kemba Walker,
they were wrong about Kemba Walker.
It is so wonderful that this has happened to him. It's again, these are the stories that we love in sports. This is not, obviously he went in the first round. in what was listening to Mitch, a pretty weak draft. So it isn't Tom Brady going to the Patriots, but when he goes out there for the tip in Charlotte, there are an awful lot of people in New York City who will be cheering.
Oh, you know, you mentioned we do have to spend a couple minutes on the Harden phenomenon.
Is he having a phenomenon?
The thing that has surfaced that is...
Other than Wilt Chamberlain, Bobby, other than Wilt scoring 50 for a season, mm-hmm. I cannot remember anything comparable to this statistically and personally in all of my years loving the NBA.
No, and we lived through the great Jordan era. We lived through Kobe, who put up some big... This is interesting, and of course, what's surfaced this week that makes this a fascinating discussion artistically about what we want in sports, what we like about this game. The three of us like this game, and he's a troubling insertion into the dialogue. In that, I don't know. You know, the numbers are huge. He has not had an assisted basket for him in weeks and you know, game 200 and some odd, well over 200 baskets. In other words, it's all the solo act. It's all step, you know, clear out for me, and it works. And by the way, they're winning as a result. But it's just so antithetical to right. what we think is the game of five. You know, I mean, he gives it up. He's had, you know, he had that 15 assist game, but the idea that all his baskets come from him dribbling, and then either A, going to the basket, or B, taking that step back three. And only rarely is there a C. Of course, he gets fouled, and he makes them.
Right.
But isn't that amazing? When you guys, I know when I first became aware of this phenomenon, it bothered me. Now, am I, you know,
no, you're not alone, because we've talked about it here, and Mike put it well, I think, is that he's the most unwatchable excellence that you can imagine. And there's like teeth gnashing as you watch him play. And I feel the same way. And we've all studied the same numbers. And yes, you can't deny winning is what it's all about. But winning it all is what it's really all about. And I just don't think that design gets you to the four wins in the NBA Finals. I think it gets you all the way to the conference championships almost every year, or gives you a shot at it. I don't know that it wins you a finals. Now, I'll stand corrected if it does. If we watch, you know, the Houston Rockets get to the NBA Finals and watch James Harden score 45, 43, 48, and 42, and they win those four games, I'll say, you know what? I guess that's the way you win in the NBA. But I don't think that gets you a championship. I think it gets you a lot of wins in the regular season, and some amazing highlights and some amazing stats, because when a guy can get off like that night after night after night, we all know that, you know, a big part of NBA winning is if the other team is even up for the game in the regular season. They're tired, it's travel, there's back-to-backs, they're just not into it. You know, we all know that. Let's all be honest about that. People don't bring their A game every night to the NBA across the roster, but he apparently does. And so by the single force of his amazing nature, he can win a lot of games by himself in the regular season. But when you plot a defense for him over the course of seven games with the top teams in the NBA, I think you beat the Houston Rockets. And that's why they've constantly looked for, you know, the complementary players for him.
Just one other thing, too, is we're currently operating without Chris Paul. And obviously, he has the ball all the time. When Chris Paul comes back, he will not have the ball all the time. As a matter of fact, I think that he will become the beneficiary of one or two or three Chris Paul assists.
I disagree. I actually
really?
Think I think Chris Paul should not have gone there. I do not think they are complementary players. I just don't think it works, Bob. I think this is their best chance to be. And I love Chris Paul. Okay, I love Chris Paul. I don't think it works there. I don't think it's ever going to work there. By the way, I'm just looking at, there were people who were watching the Knicks game the other night that I know, okay, who thought he was going to score 80 points. They really did. They thought if he wanted to, he's good. Here's his stat line, Mitch. You ready? 40 minutes, 17 for 38 field goals, 5 for 20 from 3 points, 22 of 25 from the free throw line. Gosh. 15 rebounds and 4 assists. And by the way, those 4, Bob, this speaks to your point, okay? Those 4 assists were out of 10 the Rockets had for the entire game.
Wow.
And I was talking to my friend Brian Koppelman, who obviously is one of the co-creators of billions. He's a huge basketball fan. And I was explaining to him, I was doing a podcast with him the other day, and I said, listen, why don't I love watching this guy play? And Bob, the more I talked about him, you know who his style of play? It's like Oscar 2.0. Remember how boring Oscar Robertson was in the day? And I know this sounds like blasphemy, but it was you pound the ball, back up, and then either pass or shoot, okay? Yep. And there's a lot of the big O in Harden's game.
That's an interesting thing. Just to say about Oscar, if he had a 20-footer, he wanted a 15-footer. If he had a 15-footer, he wanted an 8-footer. If he had an 8-footer, he wanted a layup. And you're right. He did dominate the 24-second clock with the ball and then, you know, decide whether he's going to shoot it or pass it. And he wasn't really a thrilling, beautiful player to watch.
But I'm coming around, Mitch. I'm coming around. I'm coming around.
That's a good point, you, Mike. I agree with you that the overall fit doesn't work, but I'm simply saying, but it will result in him having a couple of assisted baskets well, every now and then with Paul.
If that's the goal, yes, okay.
This is all artists. We're talking now. This is interesting because I started out talking about this in an artistic method, and Mitch, you turned it into a more important discussion, which is, you know, how far do you go if they had to go this way, right? And I think that's a very interesting point you raised.
Yeah.
And Mitch, as we get to the halfway, you know, the symbolic, as we move up on the symbolic halfway point.
The two-thirds way, yeah.
In the season, okay? And you're right. If when we show up for the All-Star game in Charlotte, to watch it, I mean, and it will evoke the old line from Marv Albert. One night, the Parrish McHale Bird Celtics were playing the Knicks at the Garden when it was like,
Steel.
No, what was it? Can the animal
Bannister?
Bannister, right?
Yeah,
Kenny
Bannister. Bannister.
Anyway,
Bob Thornton and guys like that. Mm-hmm. And Marv is introducing the teams right before the tip. And he says all the names, and then he just pauses, and he said, who chose up these sides? And there's going to be that feeling in Charlotte. So when we look at the season right now, order has now been restored in the Western Conference. Mitch, I will ask you this, okay? As an old Eastern Conference guy who remembers days when the bad boys ruled the world, do you believe in the Milwaukee Bucks? Do you believe in the Toronto Raptors? Do you believe in the Sixers? Do you believe in the Celtics? Because obviously the Pacers, if Oladipo's out, you know, for the year, they're gone, okay? Do you see anybody there who can win the championship?
The West? Yeah. No. I don't. I think.
Which team do you like the best? Do you believe in the Bucks? I guess is really what I wanted to ask you. They have the best record in the sport right now.
They have the best record. They have a great, great player. I don't know that I consider them the best team. Indiana is playing very well this year, you know, but they always seem to fade down the stretch.
No, if Oladipo's gone, they're gone.
They're done. And I just don't, you know, like I saw Jalen Rose made a comment about there's only one guy on the East starters who could start over on the West of the All-Stars. And it feels that way in terms of the teams, too, you know, that maybe Milwaukee gets in the tournament with Golden State, Oklahoma City, Denver, Portland, Houston, but that, you know, it's not more than one team from the East. So no. But Mike, as Bob says, last I looked, one team from the East has to play in the finals.
It's a rule.
It is a rule.
I double checked.
And you don't know who gets beat up on the West along the way. I mean, can you imagine some of the early round matchups here? If the Lakers crawl back into it, if LeBron comes back into the game, they could be a first round matchup for the Golden State Warriors, which means it ain't going to be an easy, you know, four and out. And by the time teams get to the NBA Finals, there's injuries, there's fatigue, there's all the rest of it, and you might get an upstart team from the East that can put on a show. But do I think an Eastern team is going to win the NBA Finals this year? Absolutely not.
No. Answering your question, I'll go with the I trust, if I had to rank them in order right now, Toronto, one. Boston and Philly almost tied because Philly's going to get – they're both going to get better. And I don't fully, you know, I mean, don't disrespect Milwaukee, but I would put them.
By the way, the Oladipo, it's a ruptured quad tendon. You know, so he's not going to play until next year. This is an Indiana University kid who became this kind of star and kind of an under the radar star for the Pacers. And what a wonderful season he was having, they were having. So that's a sad thing. And, you know, Mitch, when you were talking about injuries before, the Warriors – this sounds crazy. They could withstand an injury to Durant or Curry and still be the best team.
That's true. Different times over the course of this. At different times over the course of their assemblage, they have been without those guys.
Would you say that? Is this a post-Cousins declaration?
Yeah, after what we've seen, what they are is presently constituted. Okay, all I'm saying is, I don't want to attach any foreboding to this, okay? But if Durant or Curry were lost for the season, I still think they're the best team. Wow, that was a big sigh. I've known that sigh since college.
I'm just thinking, I have to imagine a world that doesn't exist here and take it all the way to the NBA Finals sigh.
I'm just
trying to think of the most logical heir apparent this year.
That's what I want to know.
Last year we knew who it was, and this year we don't
know. You think it's the Rockets? Do you still think it's them when Chris Paul comes back?
Look how close they came with doing it without Paul last year. But that's last year, and that's the way they were composed last year.
Isn't it amazing, by the way, that's why
we have the other half of the season. We don't have to decide.
Isn't it amazing, though, okay, how important a figure Kawhi Leonard has become in basketball this season? And again, it's maybe someday we will know what actually went down in San Antonio, because we do not know now. But he has been everything the Raptors could have possibly wanted him to be. And more, and reminded everybody why it was about 20 minutes ago that he was being discussed as an MVP candidate.
Right, and I mean, we're jumping ahead to a postseason. We're just not even at the All-Star game. But one of the most interesting storylines is going to be Kawhi Leonard's performance in the postseason and how far he can take Toronto versus where they had always kind of stumbled under Dwayne Casey in the past. And remember, he's playing for his career now. He's playing for the biggest contract that he's ever going to get when he's done, either going back to them or anywhere else he wants in the NBA. And so his motivation to perform on a stage that he was left out of last year for whatever reason is going to be great. But that's a half a season away and a free agency away. And we've got actually a quite a pressing free agency situation in the national pastime, if we can still call it that, of baseball, where two superstars, Machado and Harper, are still sitting out there as we round the corner in January and head to February, and pitchers and catchers report. And you start hearing all the talk about collusion and why aren't, there's a reason that these two guys, and if you listen to Scott Boras wax on philosophically about what was the line I saw him use, when you're the biggest planes, they can tell you what planes can leave the airport, but you're not going anywhere without them. Something along those lines. That's the way he's talking about his client, Bryce Harper. And what is the story? Why haven't Manny Machado and Bryce Harper been signed somewhere by now?
Well, number one, last year, J.D. Martinez was signed in the third week in February, and this is something that is being cited as an example of this things can... the historical precedent, so you do have that. But the answer is I don't know. I don't know. We keep having these rumors about the White Sox with Machado and the Phillies with Harper, and among other things. And the Phillies having all this money, and the Phillies,
Mitch,
I don't know.
Bob and Mitch, the Boras quotes, I think, Mitch, I don't know if he said them to everybody. I was reading Ken Davidoff's column in the New York Post. And Mitch, yes, he said that it's like a plane at a runway that they can tell you when to take off, but you're not going anywhere without them. Okay, that was one of the analogies he used. Right. But in the same conversation, he said this: sometimes the seeds of the crop don't start to grow until the sun shines.
Is that Chauncey Gardner?
I don't know, Mitch, but you probably, Mr. Smarty Pants, you probably never thought of it that way, did you? So he went from the plane on the runway. Sometimes the seeds of the crop don't start to grow until the sun shines.
Okay.
So it's almost like a nature lesson. Here's what I think. I don't think there's collusion of any kind. I think that, you know, you started to hear, remember 2 years ago, $400 million for Bryce Harper. And this sport is run by guys who are looking at the numbers now. Okay. And I know that this is rare. Both of the guys we're talking about are 26 years old. So it's not the dumb contract that the Angels gave Pujols. It's not the dumb contract that the Tigers gave Miguel Cabrera. It's not the dumb contract that the Yankees gave Alex Rodriguez when he opted out in 2007 during the World Series. I think that there has been an awakening in this sport that if you give anybody, I don't care who it is, a contract longer than 5 or 6 years, then it's on you. Bob, look at the contract that J.D. Martinez, who was as impactful a player as there was in the sport last year, he can be out there again after what, 2 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think people are looking at those contracts, Mitch and Bob, and saying, wait, I'm going to give a guy a $10 million, ten-year, $350 million contract. How the hell do I know what he's going to be like when he's 35 years old? I think it's Cano with the Mariners, another example of one of those contracts not working out, and now he's going to be playing for the Mets instead of the
Mariners. How about Miguel Cabrera?
Yeah, Detroit. I mentioned him with Pujols. Yeah.
I mean, they are saddled with him now, and teams take turns, and we've seen this now with the whatever phrase you want to use that basically is the process as coined by the 76ers, but now it goes all across different sports where you just pull yourself back and start all over again. And the Tigers, for example, are trying to do that here, trading away everybody. And that's why they seeded the playoffs with Justin Verlander and letting J.D. Martinez go and all the rest of it. But they can't get rid of a $30 million a year anchor on them, Miguel Cabrera, because nobody's going to take him at this point. And so they can't really fully do what they want to do, which is just go all the way back to square one. And teams are afraid of getting in those kinds of situations with these long-term contracts. His was, I don't know if it was 10 years, but it was in the neighborhood of that. And it's going to take him, you know, beyond or close to 40 or beyond 40. And he's not going to be that player. And so I'm with you, Mike. You know, but what I don't get is why nobody is nibbling, you know, like, okay, so we're going to be...
Oh, I think they're nibbling. No, I think there's a lot of nibbling. And this would be after, obviously, the seeds are planted. The crops right, are gone.
Right. And the niblets, the corn.
And the food, Mitch, and the food has been gathered, and it's been put on the table.
The harvest
okay?
is being taken
I
in.
Think there's a lot of, I think the Yankees obviously have kicked the tires on Machado. The White Sox have kicked the tires on both of them. The Phillies have kicked the tires. And teams may be waiting to say, okay, now that you're not going to get 10 years, now that you might not even get 8 years, let's talk.
Is that what you think it is? You think like they're just sort of... letting them feel the heat a little bit. All the teams collectively are just saying, let's just not make an offer until February, because then they'll start, they being the players and their agents, will start to get more desperate.
JD didn't get signed until what, about the 15th of February last year, Bob?
No, later, like the 26th. It was at least the third week in February.
Did the Sox benefit from that in terms of what they would have had to pay him if they had decided to do it in January?
I think if they had done it earlier, it would have cost them more. I think they found out that what they realized, Mitch, I think Dombrowski said, wait a minute, I'm not going to bid against myself here because I don't even know what the market was for JD. But this will also benefit JD because if he continues to produce like this, he's going to hit the market again in a couple of years. But the thing is, when he hits the market, he's going to be, 32 or whatever he's going to be at the time. And I just think that this is not just fiscal sanity. This is statistical fantasy. And this is the world of WAR, WAR, and all wins above replacement, all of that stuff. The most powerful people in this sport now really aren't the guys writing the checks, the owners. It's these numbers crunching, analytical general managers. And I just think that they're looking at this and saying, okay, do I want to be the Tigers with Cabrera in 5 years? Do I want to be trying to get out from under? Please remember that when Alex Rodriguez signed his $252 million contract with the Rangers, this was going to be the dawn of a new era with the Texas Rangers. 3 years later, they couldn't wait to get rid of this guy and get out from under that contract.
And ate a big piece of it, if I remember.
They, I think they ate like 67, I forget what it was, like $67 million. And at that time, before we knew what a juicer he was, you know, he was probably viewed as the most talented player in the game.
Yeah, and as, to Bob's point, all you got to do is look historically over the last 10 years and see how many different teams have made it with all kinds of different payrolls for those general managers and team owners to say, well, clearly overspending is not the only way that you get to a World Series here. And everybody wants to believe in their farm system or their scouts or their analytic guys, their Billy Beans. And you know, if they all think that they've got the most brilliant guy, then they almost want to outsmart money. You know, and I think it does run the risk of almost getting too far on the other side. Like, no, we don't do the big money thing around here. Because sometimes a big money player can make a huge difference on your team. But I do think you're right, Mike. The trend is to like, no, let's outthink the money market part of this, and let's do the sabermetrics, and let's find a number that no one else has found that proves that investing in that guy is not worth it, but investing in a less expensive guy is. And that is the tone of the game right now.
Yeah, I mean, they're both going to make a lot of money, okay? And that's understood. But we started this by asking about collusion. Do I believe this is collusion? No, I think this is more like a meeting of the minds with guys not even talking about that because we see how these teams are being run. And by the way, the Red Sox of 2018, Mitch, they flew in the face of this because they spent more money to win the World Series than any team has ever spent to win the World Series. I think that they became the second $200 million team to ever win the World Series. They went flying past the luxury tax threshold, and they got an owner who doesn't give a rip.
No, and who, by the way, has come out in recent times and said that they're not really making any. They haven't really made money lately, and so and if that's true. You're right. That separates him from some of the other owners.
I think that they're going to go all in to win it again, Bob. And then then they're going to have to make some decisions, obviously, because Mookie and Benintendi.
Oh, they're all going to hit at that. You know, they're 20 right. Mookie and Bogarts and Benintendi and company. They're all going to hit, and Mookie, of course, is going to be the number one guy. He settled for a nice $20 million arbitration. 1 year, and he's gonna hit that the next guy to be.
Well, let me offer a little bit of contrast to this money talk by way of shifting to the final topic. Mariano Rivera signed for $3,000. $3,000 reminds me of remember the Saturday Night Live when they offered to get the Beatles back together. The guy came out, it was Lorne Michaels, I think, came out with a check, and he said, "I'm offering the Beatles." I think it was four, you know, or maybe it was three. I think it was $3,000. You can split it any way you want. You don't want to give Ringo a full share? That's fine. $3,000. And here is Mariano Rivera after $3,000, left unprotected in the 1993 expansion draft, struggling when he first got to be a starter, and now is the first baseball player in the Hall of Fame to ever be unanimously elected, and I don't think you're going to find a lot of quarters in the sports world that think that was the wrong move.
Well, Mitch, I'm going to tee up Bob on this because Bob has a great story about as much of a gentleman as I have ever covered in a big league clubhouse. I saw the whole show from him when he was in the bullpen against the Mariners in 1995. Okay. And all the way through his triumphs, and Bob, you know this. When he did fail, the Yankees didn't win. He gave up a big home run in 97. Obviously, he gave up the single to Bill Miller in Game 4 in 2004. I will tell you this about two things that people in New York know about Rivera, but not everybody knows. The Yankees honestly thought, through the greatest career as a closer in the history of this sport, and probably the greatest we will ever see, that he would have been their best outfielder if he was an outfielder. And he got hurt one time chasing fly balls during batting practice.
Kansas City.
He was a center fielder that could have ranked just defensively with the greatest center fielders in the history of the Yankees. Here's the other thing about Mo. And I spent a lot of time in front of his locker. He was as astute a baseball man as a player as I have ever known. As long as he knew you didn't want to talk about him and his exploits and his genius and the cutter and everything, and you just got him talking about baseball, he could assess the strengths and weaknesses of his team, the other pitchers. He was a joy to know and a figure of grace for his entire career.
Well, my only little anecdote, just to verify what a gracious gentleman he was, is that I was working on a story in 2005, many years later, about Bill Miller. We had all written about Dave Roberts, you know, and the stolen base, but that was very nice, but somebody has to get him home. Bill Miller got the base hit off Rivera, and circa 2011 or 12 now, I he doesn't know me, and I go up to him at the locker because I'm working on the story. We went over the ninth inning again, and he was tremendous, very, you know, detailed and very nice, and told me how, you know, he tried to kick it. If you see it, you see that he did reach his left foot out trying to stop the ball up the middle. But anyway, point being that this rehashing would has to be the last thing in the world he probably would want to rehash at this point in time. Several years later, he couldn't have been more helpful and accommodating and grateful and gracious to me, whom he didn't know. So,
I'm curious, as you know, the veteran of the whole New York scene, how is it that he was able to be so gentlemanly, so polite, so upright, so calm in that New York media circus that has seen so many other players turn biting and angry and cynical and mean? I mean, he was in the heart of that whole, it was literally the eye of the hurricane of the New York media, the New York Yankees clubhouse for all those years. How did he do it and nobody else could?
But Mitch, there was the clubhouse of the Bronx Zoo years, okay? And then there was the clubhouse of Joe Torre's Yankees. And that clubhouse was not like the old clubhouses. There was no Bronx Zoo going on. That was O'Neill and Jeter and Cone and Moe and Pettit and Posada. This was a band of Yankee brothers as unified and as powerful. You know, there was the core four, and then there's a name that just gets totally lost in this, and it was a great player, and that's Bernie Williams, and it was really the core five, but because four of them came up together, so no, he fit perfectly in that room. He belonged with that group, and it's, you know, it's fitting that he goes in this year. Derek will go in next year, and no, that clubhouse was that was one great. I can tell you, it was a great room.
Well, I want to address this whole unanimous thing while we're here, and then we can put it the rest and, you know, move on to. I'm glad it happened. It had to happen. It was obvious and inevitable and almost incomprehensible that he wouldn't be the guy as we came up to his candidacy. It ends 83 years of embarrassment to the organization, the Baseball Writers Association of America, for not having honored similar people or worthy people.
Well, you don't think
past.
Ruth and Williams and Robinson and Mays?
It started the first year in 1936 when Ty Cobb fell four shorts shy of unanimous, and Ruth fell 11 votes shy. So it started right then. Why? Now, in Cobb's case, a lot of people thought he was a bad guy. Ruth, you know, I don't think, but thought he was a bad guy. They may have thought he was
they thought Cobb was a bad guy because he was a bad guy.
All right, fine. So then it went on and on, and we know we think we know for a fact. Mike, did you ever? I'm asking Mike and Mitch, have either of you ever spoken with an individual who was a voter, who told you, looked you in the eye and said, I have a policy, I do not vote for someone the first year, no matter who he is?
Nobody ever told me that, but obviously they're out there. I mean,
but have you conversed with any? I haven't ever.
I haven't.
But anecdotally, we know they have been out there, right? We know they've been out there.
For sure.
And so that's, to me, that's just,
it was a principle, but what a dumb.
principle?
And it's dominated the Baseball Hall of Fame in ways that it doesn't the other halls of fame. And clearly, whoever they are, invisible or silent, Baseball writers consider their vote to be something precious that has to be earned, and not just earned by your career, but earned by your waiting time. And so you deserve to have to wait X period of time before we put you in. So in other words, what became an element of the Hall of Fame was how long you had to wait to get into it. And the best players waited the shortest period of time, and the not as best players still got in, but had to wait until near the end. Such is the case, of course, with Edgar Martinez. Edgar Martinez, when he started on this journey 4 years ago, got 27% of the vote. But now he gets 85% of the vote. Now, this to me is part of the ridiculous preciousness of the Baseball Hall of Fame that they should be embarrassed about. You don't go from 27% to 85% over the course of 4 years if you weren't always basically deserving to get in. But this no, he's a designated hitter. We're not sure if designated hitter. Let's make the designated hitter wait. I always found that totally disingenuous. I agree with him and many other people who said it. If you're going to make it a position in the game, and it's been a position in the game in damn near 50 years already, why can't you get into the Baseball Hall of Fame as a designated hitter? But the preciousness of the lords of that hall wanted to make Edgar Martinez wait. Now he's in, you know, with 85% of the vote. So you tell me, Bob, as a long-term voter, what was that about except to try to teach a lesson?
All right, number one, I would respectfully disagree with you on the idea that how got people gain traction. I know in my own case, there are people for whom I do not vote for originally, and then due to my own reconsideration or further research or enlightenment from outside sources about take a better look at this guy, I've changed my mind. I mean, I didn't vote.
Bob,
for
let me give you an example, and it's from Mitch's city. I wasn't always voting for Alan Trammell, and then I sat down one day, Bobby, and I made a statistical comparison between Alan Trammell and Barry Larkin, and I know you're not supposed to play whataboutism, but it comes into your thinking, and I said, well, wait a minute, they pretty much had there's a breakdown to this, okay? I said they pretty much had the same career, and Alan Trammell ought to be in the Hall of Fame. He didn't do it on the regular ballot, and he got it inducted later. So, but Mitch, I have changed my mind on things because it's the only thing I vote on in sports. It's the only thing I vote on in sports, and I take it extremely seriously. And there have been guys, Bob, I'll tell you who I came around on: Larry Walker.
Yeah,
and
me too.
I got religion late in the church service. I did.
Mike, I'm got just to tell you this, I mean, guys. You hit Larry Walker. Here is what I wrote about Larry Walker. Okay, I had to. The Globe asked us, the five of us who vote from the Globe, to write about what they did, and I was happy to. Here's my Larry Walker quote: "What a stupid I was, withholding my Walker vote until this year. 162 game average, 31 homers, 107 ribbies, .313 batting average, .965 OPS, 3 batting titles. Oh, and are you ready? Only .363, .379, and .350. He had 409 total bases in 97. Oops, almost forgot. Throw in 7 gold gloves. Larry, mea culpa for not grasping all this sooner. I just bleeped up. That's all. In my mind."
Well, congratulations for both of you being honest and forthright, or using, saying that you bleeped up.
All right, Mitch. Here we go on the Hall of Fame. Mitch, we've had this long Hall of Fame conversation. We have not talked about the two big elephants in the room, which is Bonds and Clemens, okay? And I don't think, Mitch, they didn't get the bump that everybody, because as the voting turns over, the younger voters are way more tolerant of the whole steroid thing, okay? But they did not get the big bump this year that people thought they would get. And this leads me to another question. And I think this is going to be a provocative pick because he was a designated hitter and because, he has a murky past with that one year of testing. And that is David Ortiz. Mitch, do you think Ortiz, when he comes up, two more years, Bob? Do you think he is a lock solid first ballot entry into the Hall of Fame?
I don't know about first ballot for the very reasons that I brought this up. And some people punish or an indiscretion or the bad year, as you point out, by saying, well, I'm going to put him in eventually, but I'm not going to let him get in. You guys may not, but guys do, and I know that they do. So I can't tell you if he's going to get in on the first, but he's going to get in, because partly because of what you're saying, Mike, is that the younger voters, as they come along, and they're going to be even more of them a couple of years from now, and more of them 7 years from now when he gets to his last vote, are going to say, how could you not have? I mean, he was a dominant figure in those World Series, in those great games at Fenway Park, and he's going to get in. But I do think that's going to happen with Clemens and Bonds. And just so the people understand, so they both jumped up a couple of percentage points. So Clemens to 59.5% and Bonds to 59.1%, essentially the same. You've got to get to 75%. They've got 3 years to go. My feeling is they're not going to get elected until the last year. And then there's going to be this huge national hand-wringing debate that's going on before that vote. And people are kicking the can down the road until they take the temperature of the country or their own minds or whatever it is. And you two are part of it. So, you can tell me. But
I don't think they're going
to get in. To me, it should be this. It should be this. For some of the outside looking in on that. If you don't think that they belong in the Hall of Fame because of their steroid involvement, they never belong in the Hall of Fame. They don't belong in the fifth year of their eligibility. They don't belong, period. And if you voted against them getting in on what should clearly be based on their numbers, a first-year entry, then in the fifth year, you should also be voting for them not to get in. And if you're using your, I'm going to make them wait to screw them a little bit and make them suffer, but in the end, of course, they're going to get in, then you're using a vote in a fashion that I just alluded to is different in the Baseball Hall of Fame than it is in the other ones. And that's exactly, they're very good cases in point. So now you guys tell me, you have a vote on them. If you voted against them up till now, are you going to continue to vote on them? Why would anything change 3 years from now?
Nothing is going to change with me. And that's it. And you know, this isn't about moralizing. It's just about how I view the sport and what they did. My favorite thing at this time of year is if you don't agree with the people who say they should be in, they accuse you of moralizing when they are moralizing about you. It is like chasing your tail, okay? I do not believe that Bonds and Clemens are going to get in, and then it will fall into the hands, and God bless them, and good luck to them, into the Modern Players Committee, or whatever the hell they call it now.
Well, I plead guilty. I am moralizing. What else do I call it? Why wouldn't I vote for them based on their numbers? Bonds may be the greatest hitter of all time. Clemens is arguably the best starting right-hand pitcher of all time. But I don't vote for them. And yet I'm not, unlike Mike, I'm not going to categorically declare that I won't vote for them in the remaining 3 years. Why? Because I've been saying the same thing for 5 years at least, that I may wake up one day and say, to hell with it. I can't be the judge and jury any longer. We don't know which juice pitchers, which juice batters, blah, 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 blah. We've already let people in that are dubious, necessarily. And I voted for some people that other people think are juicers. And there's more coming. It troubles me. I wish we didn't. I'm going to say it for the trillionth time. I really resent the fact that we are having this discussion because it shouldn't be in the laps of the writers. That should be the Hall of Fame. Jeff Idelson and company, and I respect Jeff Idelson. I like him. Good Newton Mass guy. Jeff Idelson should declare that the Hall will take charge and they will do the following. They will put a disclaimer outside the plaque and room and say, there was a period of time in baseball when performance-enhancing drugs were rampant. Many of the people, and you will see in here, performing during that era. And we have decided, we have instructed our voters to vote for people only on the merits of their achievements and accomplishments, period. And you, the fan, are free to feel about these people, whoever you are, but they are in here based on their accomplishments, so be it. If they will do that, I will vote for them immediately. I will pick them up at the damn airport. I may even buy them lunch. Okay? I don't think it should be our responsibility. This is a murky topic that belongs in the lap of the Hall of Fame and not the writers themselves.
Do you think that'll ever happen?
No, it's not. I think he's publicly said that's not going to happen. And I would love to, change his mind. Also, David Ortiz, I'm going to weigh in quickly. He's going to get in. And the reason he's going to get in, despite the name on the Mitchell report, is that he's got a reservoir of goodwill that will overwhelm everything. He has positioned himself by his achievements.
Yeah, but this is goodwill hunting. I'm sorry. So he gets in because he gets goodwill, and Schilling doesn't get in because of his cockeyed political.
Well, that's what we're going to get. We have to get there. We can't exit without talking about Schilling, Mike. I'm so glad you brought him up. I'm going to ask both of you, how much of it do you think is this anti chilling personality and politics, and how much is it that people just don't feel that they feel he's a borderline candidate at best? What I mean,
he's at 61% right now. 61%.
All right, but I'm asking you, how do you think? I'm asking you what you think.
10%.
Yeah,
I think 10%. He'd be 10% higher if he didn't hold his political views or wasn't so outspoken on all kinds of topics. I don't know that he'd have gotten in yet, but I think he would. He will get in. I still think he's going to get in, even with this. You've seen. Look, if Edgar Martinez can go from 27% to 85%, you know, why can't Kurt Schilling go from 60% to 75%? But yes, I think at least 10%.
If he does get in,
off the top,
Mitch. If he does get in, before we get to our parting shots, if he does get in, you can dial me out on his speech.
There'll be a lot of people won't be.
Let me just say this, Mitch and Bob. I'll take a hard pass on this if he does ever stand at that microphone in Cooperstown. It is time for our parting shots. And since mine deals with somewhat with the subject that we... not even somewhat, more than somewhat. I will lead off today. You can apparently start running for Hall of Fame way earlier than presidential candidates start running for president. So there was Alex Rodriguez, the captain of the Biogenesis All-Stars, saying this about Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens on ESPN the other day. If you think about Roger and Barry specifically, if you stop their career at the age of 33 or 34, they were both first ballot, and then the noise about, parentheses, about PED started. For me, it's just a shame. I'm certainly cheering for both of them. I like them both very much. They're both friends, and I'm in their corner. Well, actually, Rodriguez, after not only using performance-enhancing drugs, but lying his ass off about that for years and then trying to take down even his own team doctors to save himself, was in his own corner, as always. Somehow this guy, after basically getting busted for PEDs twice in the same career and exhibiting such a shameful performance during Biogenesis, is now treated like the mayor of baseball on two different networks and has become a darling of celebrity America because of his romance with Jennifer Lopez. You don't get here without being some kind of politician. I've never met one like him in all my years covering baseball.
This just in. Bulletin, bulletin, bulletin.
What?
Australian officials have issued a warrant for the arrest of a 32-year-old Spaniard. His name is Rafael Nadal, and the charge is child abuse. Okay, I jest. But what Nadal has just done to three up-and-comers in the tennis world did border on youngins' abuse, for sure. En route to his berth in the Australian Open Finals against Novak Djokovic, Nadal wiped out whippersnappers 19-year-old Alex de Minaur, 6'1", 6'2", 6'4", 21-year-old Frances Tiafoe, 6'3", 6'4", 6'2", and then yesterday, 20-year-old Stefanos Tsitsipas, 6'2", 6'4", and a 6'love. That's a combined game score of 54-22. So much for youth. Now, afterward, Tsitsipas was full of wonder and amazement. Said the young Greek, and I quote, "He gives you no rhythm. He plays just a different game style than the rest of the players. He has this, I don't know, talent no other player has. I've never seen a player like this. He just makes you look bad," unquote. And so there it is, folks. A tribute out of the mouth of babes. This week, Rafael Nadal was not just a great tennis player. He was a predator.
When it came to remaining calm in a huddle, no one was more chill than Joe Montana. And perhaps now we know why. The four-time Super Bowl champ is a prominent investor in California's budding marijuana industry. Sorry about the budding. Montana is part of a $75 million investment with Caliva, a Northern California-based cannabis company that bills itself as the number one dispensary in the nation. With Montana's help, it plans to develop a new pot farm, pot distribution center, and pot delivery service. Now remember, the NFL, Montana's former employer, still fines and suspends players for marijuana use. Meanwhile, Montana will be selling it freely. He says pot, quote, "can provide relief to many people and can make a serious impact on opioid use or addiction." Well, as someone who has family members with chronic pain issues, I do see the medical benefits of marijuana. But to suggest that you're in it to diminish addiction is disingenuous. Arguments are strong that marijuana often indeed jumpstarts people to greater addictions, no matter how uncool that is to say. And if Montana thinks his only customers in a legalized marijuana state like California are going to be needy patients, well, he's high. Hey, Joe Cool can be Joe Cool any way he wants. But as more athletes endorse and even invest in this industry, let's at least be honest. You may smoke it for pleasure or pain relief, but you sell it for profit. That's going to wrap things up for today's program. This is the Sports Reporters podcast that you hear every Monday and Friday. If this is your first time listening, please tell your friends about it. Leave us a comment if you like, and let everybody know that you can get it anywhere you get popular podcasts, including radio.com. We will see you on Monday. And until then, on behalf of Mike Lupica and Bob Ryan, this is Mitch Albom saying, have a great weekend.